People in Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The topic of this panel is the old timers in AA. And I have now asked Daniel F. to read a passage from the AA literature related to the topic.
Hi, everyone. My name's Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Daniel.
This brings us straight to the question. Does AA have a real leadership? Most emphatically, the answer is yes, notwithstanding the apparent lack of it. Let's turn again to the deposed founder and his friends. What becomes of them? As their grief and anxiety wear away, a subtle change begins. Ultimately, they divide into two classes known in AA slang as elder statesmen and bleeding deacons. The elder statesman is the one who sees the wisdom of the group's decision, who holds no resentment over his reduced status, whose judgment, fortified by considerable experience, is sound, and who is willing to sit quietly on the sidelines patiently awaiting developments. The bleeding deacon is one who is just as surely convinced that the group cannot get along without him, who constantly convives for re-election to office, and who continues to be consumed with self-pity. A few hemorrhage so badly that, drained of all AA spirit and principle, they get drunk. At times, the AA landscape seems to be littered with bleeding forms. Nearly every old-timer in our society has gone through this process in some degree. Happily, most of them survive and live to become elder statesmen.
All right. Now I would like to welcome our first speaker, Joe C. from Worcester, Massachusetts.
My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
I'm a member of the Way Out Group, Worcester, Mass. It's a privilege to be here. Told me to speak between 15 and 20 minutes. I'm going to shoot for 10. That should get us right in there somewhere. Probably 21. But it's great to be here, and the topic is old-timers. But I like the reading about elder statesmen. But I'm going to share a little bit about. I'm a little uncomfortable with the topic. It's been something. I've been studying for the last 10 years or so in young people's of Alcoholics Anonymous. To get some of the demographics out of the way, my sobriety date's December 6, 1982. I was 20, and I turned 50 in August. And I'm a little freaked out. you know, I've been to well over 300 AA conventions, mostly of them young people's conventions, and very active on the convention scene. And you know, since I turned 50, I've been asked to speak at three young people's conventions. It wasn't Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, relationship panels. It's been the old-timers panel. Three in a row. And I've been kind of, and I got another one looming, and it's not a old-timers panel, but they want me to do like a little history workshop, which is really code for old timer, right? And I've been studying the, you know, I got sober at 21 and grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, but specifically the fellowship part of my sobriety has been really around young people's meetings. I go to many meetings, but really my service and fellowship has been around the YPAS scene. I also have a program of recovery out of the 12-step big book, the 12 steps in the big book. But so I've been, the last 10 years or so, I've been watching people who've grown up in young people's AA. Those of us with, say, 20-plus years, coming into our 40s, and Now, I still think I'm 25. I look out and I feel 25. But I know the people don't see that 25. I mean, I was a player, and I had hair, and I have a 19-year-old daughter, and you know, I was divorced, so I took her shopping most of her life, and I don't know, somewhere between 12, 13, and 14, we were going into American Eagle at a mall, and she gave me a look that said, "Dad, do not come in the store. You're going to embarrass me. When I'm ready to check out and pay, then you can come in." And I was at a conference about 5 years ago, and I was hanging out with a group of young attendees, attractive young women, and talking and trying to be hip, slick, and cool, and they all were giving me the American Eagle look. Like, who's this? Who's the old guy? And I'm like, no. So that's just something in the general community and in the YPAR scene that I'm going through, and I hope to talk a little bit about perhaps being an elder statesman back on the firing line, back in my home group. You know, I love conventions, but to me they're a weekend, a celebration, and I come to young people's conventions for three reasons still, because, you know, growing up in young people's AA, it's a funny thing. When I first got sober, and, you know, my family and different, you know, about 4 or 5 years into the deal, people outside of AA at work or in my family would say things to me like, "You're still going to that AA thing?" And they didn't get it, that this had become a way of life. This was not only, you know, I was staying sober, but I was learning how to live life. And, you know, when you grow up in young people's AA, and you go to young people's conventions for well over 20 years, people in regular AA or grown-up AA, whatever you want to call it, start saying to you, "You still going to those young people's things?" And, you know, they don't get it. And I come for three reasons. I'm 50 years old, and I still go to many conventions, but I come... you know, other than the obvious, my sobriety. I mean, that's the obvious reason. I'm still chasing my sobriety. But it's developed into like a reunion for me. I see my AA community isn't just Worcester. It's the whole country. I have friends all over the country. And you develop these relationships. And they're all in different stages. And you spend time with people. You know, we just have this bond. We have this common problem, this common solution. The second reason I come is my wife, who's here with me this weekend. We love to travel, so it's a great excuse. I mean, I'm having the perfect weekend, the balance between AA, and it's not easy to do, to find the balance, you know. I know some people here who are hiding in the meetings because they're afraid to go into Vegas because, you know, we got defects of character, and this is a kind of a fertile area to indulge in some things. And but I also know some friends who are missing the conference right now. The third reason is sponsorship. I really, really enjoy bringing new guys and exposing them to this aspect of sobriety. And it's not for everybody. Some people don't like conventions, but when I see a new guy that I sponsor, and you know, we've done the work through the big work, and he's in and he's active in the home group, and we come and he discovers this excitement and has that experience. So I enjoy that. What I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is every now and then, you know, people who come into my home group and put a year or two together, they tend to take the old timers and put them on this little pedestal, like, "Man, I can't wait till I have 20 plus years." Like there's something magical about time. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trading in my time. But, you know, they're very powerful. You know, we're like the power of example, like, "Oh, you've been coming around and doing this," or whatever. But, like, they're very powerful to me to watch them come in, like grab hold of these principles, awaken, recover, and begin working with other people and to continually see the miracle. And I like to say that the time is an illusion. Now, I've been practicing this way of life and gotten better, but this is the first time that I have ever stayed sober, January 28, 2012. This is a new day. This is a new season of my sobriety. I'm in my 50s. I've been in a relationship, married, coming up on 10 years this year. Second marriage, the first one was practice, but this is the first, that's a long, that's a record for me. 10 years, 12 years with the same woman. This is the first time I've had a 19-year-old daughter who's a sophomore in college and goes to school in Birmingham, Alabama, dealing with the long distance. I have a 21-year-old son with 10 months sobriety. I've never been a dad in AA before. This is all new. And through the years, I have a home group. I have a fellowship of people back home on the firing line. You know, I come here and I celebrate, but this isn't like where I stay sober on a day-to-day basis. You know, this is where I might come in and put my game face on a little bit and reunion and travel and all that stuff, but it's back home. The speaker last night was talking about old-fashioned AA. I think he was referring to kitchen table AA. And I don't really meet guys at the kitchen table. We do a lot of work in the front seat of my truck. And it's a privilege to be here and speak and share my experience, strength, and hope. But I would trade it in a heartbeat to be working with a new guy who wants to go through the 12 steps and get and meet with me on a weekly basis and go through the big book. That's, you know, the front lines. But what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to say, like, just because 29 years old, what are you doing today? How are you handling the curveballs today? You know, I understand lines in the big book today where it talks about having a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I understand where it says we pause when agitated or doubtful. I understand in Bill's story when he says, you know, we must have this, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, we must enlarge our spiritual life to survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. It's a design for living that works in rough going. The curveballs are coming. Life is coming. And how do I handle it? And it's a practical program of action. These principles, these ancient principles, are codified in a manner in the big book that I get it. I didn't get it, you know, going to church as a kid. My parents did. I'm not here to bash religion. My parents were able to tap into a higher power and live happy lives by going to church. It's not the message I got. But here, I was able to do these things and get this result. But it's not a one-and-done deal. There's a practical program of action. And I bring that up because Friday morning, actually Thursday, I registered. Getting my days a little, we get into midnight Wednesday. But on Thursday, I think they opened registration. And I registered. And I was over in that little area there, and I didn't know anyone. And I got some fear. Doesn't anybody know who I am? How come nobody's coming up to me? Oh, I really am separate. I really am old. What am I doing at this young people's conference? I don't belong. This was a mistake. Ah, oh, and I just paid $30. What am I doing here? And I started to spiral in some self-pity. Curveballs. And I made a decision. Well, maybe I'll go into the city. Because, see, I need a solution for those uncomfortable. I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. I like those three words, but I also like anxiety, worry, fear, remorse, morbid reflection, self-pity, self-condemnation, self-loathing. These things come at me. I still get the I wake up and you know, I have to immediately, you know, the book uses words like immediately, at once. You know, the speaker talked about it now. I got things I got to do. You know, I can't let these things take root, grab hold. So I got up yesterday morning after this Thursday experience and feeling apart from, and I was in my room having my morning meditation. It's a thing I developed based on a suggestion. I spend time in the morning getting spiritually connected because left alone, I spiral out of control. And I started to read a little bit and think a little bit and pray a little bit. And I remember I've told thousands of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous at their first convention, hey, look, it's going to get crazy this weekend. There's going to be choo-choo, rah-rah, and there's going to be times where you're part of the club and it feels great and you're connected. But sometimes you get blinded and there's going to be a spot where you look around and you're all alone and you want to go to the room and everybody knows everybody and you're a loser and you're going to get this feeling. And what you need to do is go out and shake 25 hands. You need to go out and say, you know, how you doing? I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Worcester. How you doing? Just go meet people. Something happens. Or go to a marathon meeting and share. So as I've given that advice, you know, over the years, that's what I need to do. So I left my room because it's a practical program of action. There's things I can do. In addition to praying and asking God to direct my thoughts and my action, I can, you know, give me knowledge and power. What do you want me to do? Give me the strength to do it. So I get up and I said, all right, oh my gosh, I'm separated. I'm alone. I need to participate in the conference. I'm 29 years sober. How could this happen to me? This isn't supposed to happen. I have time. No, bullshit. So I went to the guided meditation at 8 o'clock. I wanted to go participate, and it was great. And I said, okay, it was over. I need to start shaking hands. And I just turned around to the people who were in the room. And I met Johan and Niles from Scandinavia, and I didn't have to pretend I knew where it was. You know, I could actually say, where the hell's that? Europe. And then I was calling them the Europeans, and I didn't have to say, like, so I just said, hey, is it cool to call you the Europeans? And he says, yeah, you're the American, you know. And I was like, all right. And they wanted a coffee. They didn't know where Starbucks was. And I said, I know where it is. It's over in the Hard Rock. And I became of service. It may not seem like a service commitment, but I walked them over to the Hard Rock Cafe. And we got some coffees, and they were going to stay, and I was going to bring a coffee back to my wife. And it was magic. I got back to the room, and I gave the put the coffee next to the bed for my wife, woke her up, and I said, I'm going to go for a run. And I went out for a five-mile run. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying I went for a five-mile run. No. But it was great. And I came back and did some more AA stuff. But the whole day I was very conscious about not just walking by people. Like I needed to, you know, not just look for the pretty people, you know, who's the cool, who's the popular, you know, just, how you doing, I'm Joe, how you doing, I'm Joe, how you doing, I'm Joe. And then I went to a wedding at Graceland, some friends of mine were renewing their wedding vows 10 years ago, they got married, and Elvis performed the ceremony, and went out and had some fellowship with some sober people, and did some things, and you know, went to the meeting last night and was just, I'm here. You know, I have tools today to navigate the curveballs. And I'm at 16 minutes, 45 seconds, so it's probably going to be the 20, not the 15. So, you know, I have tools. And that's the same thing, whether that's in my marriage or in my parenting or in my finances or at work or at a convention. I have tools to deal with it. And I'll kind of just wrap up a little bit. You know, back at my home group, we get probably 100 people every week, and it's a big book meeting. It's not a big book step study meeting, but we read the big book and we study it, so you figure it out. It's big on sponsorship, and it's big on fellowship, and it's big on the 12 steps as they're laid out in the big book. We do a lot of great fellowship activities, dinners and campouts and workshops and whatever. But we're always on the lookout for the new guy, and, you know, the big book tells me, you know, as a result of the 12 steps, I'll have a spiritual awakening. You know, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we're charged with two things. We try to carry this message, the message that you too can have a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps. This is how I did it, as the steps are laid out in the book. And I'm charged with the second thing, to practice these principles in all my affairs. Kind of like yesterday. What am I doing? And so I over the years, you know, I don't know, you know, elder statesman, bleeding deacon. I know both of those terms very well. I've served on many conference committees, and I've you know, like, it goes right back to my first home group when I rotated out of the setup, and the chairs were set up wrong the next week. That's the bleeding deacon feeling, you know, when you rotate out, and the next guy sucks at making coffee, you have officially arrived at bleeding deacon. And over the years, you get to realize the wisdom. I guess the elder statesman would be like, oh, I had my experience of learning how to set up and make the coffee and show up and be responsible, and they gave me a key, and I need to let someone else have that experience. I can share my experience, strength, and hope when asked. Or if I'm a sponsor, he's invited me into his life, and I can be a little more forceful than that. But so I love my home group. I love all the guys I sponsor. I like to be on the firing line of life and just share a little of my experience, strength, and hope. I'm 50 years old, 29 years sober. I'm still on my spiritual journey. I'm still growing. I'm still navigating life, and I like to stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, so thanks.
Thank you, Joe.
Appreciate it.
All right, I'm privileged to know since I moved to Las Vegas. And I would like to welcome Don M. from Las Vegas.
I'm Don, alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
This happens to me, yeah. I'm so privileged to be sober. It was the same time when I first came to AA, I had no feelings whatsoever. And I was about 15 years sober, and I shed my first tear. Well, that's many years ago, and since that time, all I do is start talking, and I start crying because I'm grateful to AA. And as I go along, and I lose the tears. But I'm grateful for that, because my life has changed so dramatically over the years. It's just hard to believe. I came to AA in a small town in Bozeman, Montana. Bozeman, Montana. All right, there's somebody out there from Bozeman?
Billy,
well, that's right down the street. I had a good drinking town. And I've been through, you know, all of those particular areas and states and that type of thing. And I ended up in jail in Bozeman, Montana. And that was the 17th time I'd been in jail. And it just seemed as though once I started going to jail, I couldn't help it. It didn't make any difference whether I was, you know, whether I was in a suit or in overhauls or ever what the hell it was. And so I got thrown in Bozeman, Montana. And I woke up that next day, and here I am, and thank God for this, in a dirty, rotten jail in Bozeman, Montana. And any of you folks ever been in jail? I doubt if you have. But you'll know that sometimes there's clean jails and sometimes there's dirty jails. And had this been one of these spiffy little jobs, I probably wouldn't have been sober today. I'd probably been 6 feet under at the same time. But what happened was there were three men in there. One was a drunken carpenter who had been sober in AA, and the other two were hobos that were just traveling around the country. And you all know how it is before you got sober. You're remorseful, guilty, and just can't stand yourself.
and I'm prancing around that jail cell, and they're doing their thing. They're just watching me, and I'm talking. And I said, Jesus, you know, I just can't. I've been in jail 17 times, and I just can't quit drinking and this and that. They said, son, did you ever try AA? AA, what the hell is that? And they explained to me about AA. And my God, it made sense that, you know, a person can come into this place and they can want to be sober, or they can come in here and they don't want to be sober, and a lot of the don't want to be's still get sober, and the don't want to be's go out and get drunk and die. And those men took the next 3 days, because we were kind of on a holiday about that time, explained the AA way of life to me. And God dang, it sure sounded good, but how do you stop drinking? Well, so that 3 days, we went before the judge, and he said, you know, we've got this new thing there in Montana. Now, this is in 62, and they said, we got this thing over at the Looney Bin that you can go over there and get so many days of education, and I won't fine you a darn bit. I said, well, hell, I'm not going to some drunken place. And he said, okay, you're fined $500. And where did I get that $500? I had to call my parents. Here I am, a man 31 and a half years old with four boys and can't raise $500. So he sent me the money, and that was the start of my sobriety trip. And I left Bozeman, Montana, went to my little home group, and they said to me, you know, Don, it's great to see you. And I said, well, doggone, I'm just here to get some information. And they said, we've been expecting you. And thank God for that. They took me in, put their arms around me. And again, those men, and thank God there weren't any ladies there at the time, you know, because you know how that stuff works. And they just, like a herd, took me in, showed me the way, and thank God for that. And after I was 2.5 years sober, I moved down to Denver. I had a chance, an opportunity to get a job there, and I took it. And again, AA was the front of my life. And as time has went by, this has been a complete change from being a drunk, partying, good guy, thought I was really sharp, and to a guy that got sober and now is living a good life. And hey, this life beats the hell out of the other side after you've got a little sobriety. So if you're new here or comparatively new, get in the herd and make sure you get people around you, shake some hands, and please just make them notice you, and they will wrap their arms around you and you'll be free. But my travels, go to Denver, and there's a couple of guys there, and I know you're not supposed to use the last names, but a kid by the name of Jack Gorey and another fella by the name of, I can't even think of his name now, but that's just the old time setting in, I'll tell you. And they decided to go to a young people's conference in St. Louis, Missouri. Well, there's only 5 young people in AA that's under 40 years old in all of Denver, Colorado. And by God, so Jack Gorey and my friend that I can't think of his name head out there. They go down, and you've heard about how you've got a great big presentation to get this meeting and young people's and AA and stuff. And Jack and Mike Dwyer said, oh yeah, we've got 30 people out there in Denver, you know, that are young people. They said, well, good, that sounds good. You can have the conference. Now, think about that. So, anyhow, the next year comes the conference, and we're there plugging away, trying to get it going, and by God, pretty soon people start sifting in. And I'm the oldest guy there. I'm about 32 at the time, or 33, maybe 34. I can't even remember. But that's pretty old for young people nowadays. But at that time, it was, if you were above 30 or around, you were really doing something. And that's what's so nice about this young people's thing, is you can come and be here and be sober, like this fellow on my right. I know him real well. This fellow over here, been sober many, many years. And you come and you get a different life. And let me tell you, this life is more exciting than all those drunken rushes you get and all those kind of things that happen out there. Because I tell you, I've been on both sides of the fence, and you have too, and you just know how good this is. But a little bit about how we got that young people's going in Denver, Colorado. So we had the five of us as the core, and we're putting on a conference, and we go in and talk to the Brown Palace, and they say, oh, sure, all you got to do, you know, is have $300 put down and all that kind of stuff so that we can reserve the rooms for you. And this one kid was a sharp guy, and he's going to pay in a couple of weeks, but we want to reserve these dates, and they did. And we put that conference on, and we had 300 people come to that conference. Now, that's about the 9th or 10th young people's conference in Alcoholics Anonymous, national, international. And, man, it was nothing but a success. And that day, in those 3 days we did that, I've never seen so much camaraderie. And people just, I got goose pimples thinking about it now. And that's why when I go to these young people's conferences, I look around and I see the people just rotating toward each other, just like magnets. And what a privilege we've got to have that going on. And so we got started. And we got to get a place to meet. And none of the old timers wanted anything to do with it. They said, no, we're not going to, you can't come into this building, you can't come into that building. Then a man by the name of Reed Edgar stepped up. And again, went to bat for us. And we got a place to have a meeting. And we got to have that meeting for a while. And then that place closed its doors. And the next place was the telephone company, of all people, offered us a place to have a meeting. It was upstairs in an old abandoned building. And here were these telephones stacked up on each side of us. And then in the middle, we had a little place where we could hold our meeting. Well, they closed that place down. And then where do we go? Well, nobody offered us a place, and we couldn't get one at 1311 York in Denver yet. But we're about ready to break through. So we had our meeting in Cheeseman Park in the gazebo. And if any of you have ever been to Denver, you know Cheeseman Park's a great big place. And luckily enough, by then, it was springtime, and it was nice. And we held our meetings outdoors in the gazebo. And man, we had just a great time, and people were getting comradeship together. And then somebody said, well, let's go down to the prison. So we went to the prison, started putting on a meeting down there. And several of the people that we were sponsoring there in the prison said they'd talk to the warden, and then we went and talked to the warden, and we got to have two people come out each year from the state prison to come to our young people's thing that we would hold in Denver just as a local place, and then they could go to the regular meetings too. So we finally cracked into the main conference of Denver, and so here come these two guys, and they came for a couple of years, and then, of course, we had the couple of the beautiful ladies that teamed up with them a little bit. You know, not much, of course, couldn't have, you know. And the third year, we had the prisoners from the state of Colorado prison. They somehow missed the bus going back. And we just wondered what those two girls had to do with it, you know. But those are all the funny stories and the good things and funny things that happen in AA. But it goes on and it goes on. And the young people's in AA keeps on trudging. And it does a hell of a job. And another thing we did a lot in the early days was we would travel. and then we'd go down like to, we'd get a bunch and we'd go down to the top of Texas, and all of you have done these things now, and you've come here to Denver, or to, see, I love Denver, so, but you come here to Las Vegas and give us the privilege of being with you, and, you know, things just keep on trudging, and they're so good, and in my own sobriety, I live here in Denver, and man, things just happen like crazy. But one of the things that I'll go back and talk about, I'm sober, and 10 months later, I was gifted with a girl. My wife had a daughter. And just think, now, I'm married, I've got 5 boys, and who comes popping in but this little daughter at the end of that? Hey, how about that for sobriety, huh? I'll tell you, so that changes your life all around. And many years later, she said, Dad, I'm sure glad the last boy is out of the house. I said, oh, why? She says, I'm free at last. You know. You can imagine having all those brothers keeping an eye on you and can't turn around, for Christ's sake, you know. But that has been, just the story of my life has been just things. But again, the AA group, I cannot say enough about that, especially if you're new. You know, go out and shake a couple hands and just tell them, hey, I'm fairly new here, and I need, you know, somebody to hang my hat on a little bit. And those guys will turn around and get you with other guys, and the same with the girls. And I'll tell you what, this AA, you cannot beat it. And my story doesn't, you know, it just put it this way. I had a lot of fun, got in a lot of trouble, and got sober, and got in a lot of trouble, and am still sober. So, see, it doesn't change that much. It's just that the bad things leave and the good things come in. And, you know, life has been beautiful, and it still is beautiful. And, you know, I could tell you a lot of funny, funny stories, but I'm telling you what, it's just, believe me, this is the place to be. And for God's sake, don't give it up just for one drink or another drunk or something like that. And please, just hang in. And I love you all. I really do. And I'm so glad to be here. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, right on time. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Oh, by the way, sober 49 years.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. And now for our next speaker, I also have the privilege and honor to know this guy, and God, this guy's been sober since he was a kid. Does he still look like a kid? Well, yeah, he's got a little bit of gray coming in there. Kim R. from Las Vegas.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Kim.
Kim.
My sobriety date's October 3rd, 1981, and I'm grateful for that. And, wow, I've known Don for a long time, and Joe, it was great hearing your story. And I was sitting there listening to these two gentlemen, and I'm thinking about when I was brand new. Went to my first meeting when I was 16 years old. And I was reflecting on the fact that when we got here, well, before I even began, I want to say thank you to Gina and Lori and the rest of the committee for asking me to come and do this. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially at a young people's meeting. I just lost my train of thought. When I got here, like I said, I was 16 years old, and I went to my first meeting, and up until that point, I didn't know anything about this deal. I was drinking and drugging like everybody else, and, you know, I was thinking Alcoholics Anonymous is full of a bunch of alcoholics, but in this room, it's probably made up of tweakers, dope fiends, drunks, you know, all kinds of people. And I was all of those people, because I used all those other outside issues besides alcohol, you know. When I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, finally, after a year of going to meetings, the thing that took me down was alcohol, you know. And I'm going to be honest with you and tell you that when I hit my bottom, I hit my bottom with two other drunks. We all went out and drank together. We were having a party, you know. We were going to go have some fun. The morning when I came to, I got sober in California, by the way, and I got sober up in Ventura County, and I don't know if there's anybody here from Ventura County, but I got sober up in a little town called Camarillo, and there was a state hospital up there. I probably should have been there a couple of times. And I came to in this park, and it was wet, and the place that I was staying that night that I left to go get drunk didn't want me to come back, obviously, because they were all sober. Originally, the group of drunks where I got sober was about, I'm going to say, 150 kids deep. You know, and I'm going to tell you, I didn't get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in another program, and I found my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting when I was about 10 months sober. And from there, I ran the gamut. But the gamut being Ohio Street and Radford and Rodeo and all the big meetings in L.A., and I ended up at, before I left California, I ended up at places like the Allen S. Club and the Reseda and the San Fernando Valley and the Rafters in Newhall and all those fun places, right? And so I walked into my first meeting when I was 16, and I changed my sobriety date 5 times. And then finally that last drunk happened. And, you know, I think it's really hard for a young person. It was really hard for me to really believe that I could be done. I was 17 years old. It was a couple months after my 17th birthday. And a lot of stuff had taken place in my family system and in life in that first 17 years that I'm sure everybody in this room has gone through, to changing schools, all kinds of stuff that we did or that we didn't have any choice about when we were young. So I went through all that stuff, and 3 or 4 kids took me to my first meeting. And, you know, I really wasn't quite sure what to make of this deal. And even when I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I wasn't quite sure to make of that deal. There were a lot of old people there. I'm probably the youngest old-timer here, I'm sure. I'm 47, and that's neither here nor there, but I kind of like to take credit for that, you know. I have the running joke that I like to think to myself is that, you know, most of the guys that I know are 20 or 25 years older than me, and I've got as much time as they do, or close, you know. I went through a lot of stuff, and I changed my sobriety date a lot, and I don't know if there's anybody here who you can call it. If you can call yourself a relapser, okay. I didn't get this on the first deal. I couldn't. But when I finally started doing this deal, my whole life started to change, you know. And I don't know about anybody else, but I didn't have the trust of my parents. My family didn't really know what I was doing. They just kind of went along with the show the way they did when they were trying to raise me. You know, my mom, I lived with my mom most of the time that I was growing up, and I also have a younger brother, and, you know, she was trying to raise two boys who we just ran amok. You know, there was no control. I don't know if anybody else had that situation, but my mom had absolutely no control over me, and when she threatened me with Dad, I knew it was just an idle threat because he wasn't around, you know. And my dad's got about 22 years now, by the way. He's a member of this program, too. And I'm really grateful for that. I am. My mom was just here in October. My wife threw a 30th anniversary party for me in October, and I had no idea that my mom was going to be here. And I walked into the room. We have a club over here on the other side of town called the TIE Club, and there's some locals here who know about that place. And when I walked into that room and saw my mom, I was just floored. I could not believe that she had come down here. And she was here when I turned 25, and there was a little party for me when I turned 25, too, and I knew she was coming. But this time it was just different. You know, it seems like over the years, one of the things that's happened to me is that I've been able to get closer to my family a little bit at a time. I always think about that living amends that I have to make, because I was just a rotten kid. I was a rotten kid. I probably wasn't as rotten as other kids, or maybe I was more rotten than other kids, but I think I was just a rotten kid. You know, particularly bad. I went to jail a bunch of times. I was just thinking about, I just bought this sports car. My wife kindly allowed me to do that. Years ago, I did that at some point years ago, and I remember I got pulled over in that little MG that I had just bought. Actually, I got it from my mom, I think. And I think it didn't have, the headlights weren't working or something. Anyway, I'm about 6 or 8 years sober, 5 or 6 years sober, and I get pulled over on the side of the road in the San Fernando Valley, and there's like 6 cops there trying to figure out who I am all over a car, and they thought it was my brother for some reason. My brother has a sordid past. Mine's pretty sordid too, but he's got me beat. And I love my brother. I talk to him periodically, but he's, I shouldn't really share my opinion about that, but there's a lot of people who probably should be who are never going to make it here, who can't get here, you know? I really think that God, my God, gave me that gift, you know, the gift of sobriety, that gift that is so precious to us. People joke at me about being an old-timer. I'm like, I don't know. I'm still young at heart because I want to do kid stuff most of the time. I want to buy toys. I want to ride my motorcycle. I want to go to work and spend all my money. I do. I want to do all that stuff. I want to go on vacations forever. I don't want to go to work. You know, I work with a lot of young people. I have a great job. I work in the field of recovery, and that's like, it's not that big of a deal. I go to a job just like everybody else. I want to do all that stuff, and I love being a kid, and at the same time I can be an adult most of the time, right? I get to be an adult. I have responsibility. I show up at a job every day. I have to pay bills just like everybody else, you know. But because I do all that stuff, I get to do stuff like this, you know. I was just thinking about the very first conference I ever went to was the 6th annual San Fernando Valley Convention. I think that was back in 19, maybe 83. I think they're on 24, 25 now. I had a blast, man. I was young. I was about 19, 20 years old, and I was chasing everything, just having a great time, you know. And I did that for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was single. I had a lot of freedom. I could do whatever I wanted, and I had a blast. And, you know, it kind of prevented me from working the steps for a while because I was having so much fun. You know, and I want to tell you, I did have sponsorship. I can't leave that out. I've had 5 sponsors since I've been sober. I didn't get my first sponsor until I was almost 6 years sober. There's neither here nor there. It doesn't say anything about in the book about having a sponsor, you know, at least in the first 103 pages, which is where I get my program from. Eventually I had to find that one guy who was going to help me. It wasn't because I was in a jackpot. It wasn't because anything was wrong. It was because, well, maybe I was just starting to get dumb in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed some more help. I needed some direction, you know. And that guy, his name's Joe G. He's my first sponsor, and he'll always be my first sponsor. He's from Selmar, California. He's a short little one-eyed Texican and mean. Used to rob banks and all that good stuff. And he was perfect for me, you know. He loved me. He was my sponsor until I was about 13 and I moved to Las Vegas. So he loved me for 6 years and got me through a lot of stuff and helped me do a lot of stuff. I'm really grateful for that. The Elder Statesman thing and the Bleeding Deacon thing, I want to talk a little bit about my home group because I've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. My home group here is called the Stray Dogs Men's Stag. Arf, arf, there's a couple people here who know about that meeting. And where's the meow?
Meow.
Right, there you go. You know, it's really a small meeting. When I started that meeting 9 years ago, I was a bleeding deacon. That's all there is to it, you know. And, you know, if you ask any of the guys that have been in that meeting the whole time I've been there, they'll tell you so. And what that meeting has taught me over the years is that I don't get to be right all the time. I don't have to be right all the time. And that I get to be happy, right? So we meet once a week on Monday night. Our meeting has been displaced on several occasions in the last 9 years. We've been in people's houses. We've been in my house. We've been in rec rooms of mobile home parks. We've been in dilapidated buildings. We've been in a number of places, and now we have a home at this little place called the Eagles Lodge over on Washington and Bruce downtown. You know, I had to let go of all the ideas and the attitudes I had about how that meeting was supposed to be. And I had to let go of all my ideas about how I was supposed to be and all this stuff. And it's that I was thinking about Joe talking about the chair thing, because in my previous home group, I was the chair dude for 18 months in that meeting, the double-digit meeting. And I got a resentment the very next week because somebody wasn't setting up the chairs right, you know. I did. And, you know, it went away really quick because I was finally free of that commitment, thank God. But that little home group has taught me how to just sit back and listen. And I've learned that patience is really worthwhile, because if I just sit back and let them do whatever they're going to do as a group, everything works out just fine. And as it turns out, they very rarely ever ask me what to do. Thank God. You know, I think they're better off. Those are some of the lessons that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Though, you know, I've gone from being a kid who had no responsibility to being a person who's grown up and become a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know I'm a man because I'm turning gray right here where it counts. I've become a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not learn the skills of living from my family or from going to school or from doing any of the things that those quote-unquote normal folks do. I don't know what normal is. Those people who don't suffer consequences the way we do when they do what we do, right? Everything I know about living, I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I know about living, I've learned from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, like gentlemen like Don, you know, and other men that I watch on a regular basis, Donna's sponsor, Roger, you know. And these are men who are kind enough to welcome me into their world and make me feel a part of. And for a long time, you know, I'm not able to talk about, like, the very beginning of my story, but for a long time I felt apart from everything as a kid. I didn't fit in anywhere. Nobody could make me happy. Didn't matter what you did, I wasn't going to be okay. And when I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and other people who were like me, my whole life started to change and things got better. And I have, they say this is for fun and for free, right? They say that this is for fun and for free. That's what I learned when I first got here, and I learned how to have a lot of fun. It did. It was free most of the time. Sometimes it costs a little bit of money, but for the most part, you know, really what that means to me is that I get to be happy just being who I am today, you know. There's no question about who I am today. I don't doubt what I do. I don't doubt the people I'm hanging around with. I don't doubt the relationship I'm in. I don't doubt the friends that I have in my life. I lay my head down at night, every night, and 99 nights out of 100, I don't have any trouble going to sleep. Last night was an exception for some reason. I think I've been up going on 24 hours for some reason. But maybe it's because we just stopped smoking. I don't know. I'm wearing like a 21-milligram patch. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. The last time I stopped smoking, it's a good thing you weren't here because it was a riot. I spoke at one of the bigger meetings in town, and it was pretty crazy. I've managed to mellow out a little bit since then. But I get to do things today, and I get to be happy. I don't have to be right anymore. And somebody was talking about kitchen table sobriety. That's what we do at our house. We have a table in our kitchen. We sit down with that newcomer, and we read the book. That's what we do. That's my job today, right? That's my job, is to pass this on, what was so freely given to me, to another drunk. I think I'm out of time. Thank you for letting me share.
One of the great things about having 49 years of sobriety, Don is asked to come back up and add just a tidbit more. So, Don, one more time, please.
Well, I'm Don the alcoholic. One of the things that happen is you know things and you forget them and then you try to find them and sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't. But I'll tell you what, you guys are having a great time here. Now, about 30 years ago, I was in Denver, Colorado, and I sponsored a guy, and we became nice friends and that, and he got married, had a baby, and my God. So right now, I'm going to break somebody's anonymity a little. Patrick, would you please stand up here, please? Just stand up. Okay. His son, I was at his baptism of his son 30 years ago in Denver, Colorado. And today, his son is someplace in this convention with us. That's what we're doing.
Once again, help me thank all of our guests today. Once again, yes. Okay, the Wacky Paw 15 host committee would like to thank all of the conference participants and attendees for making this weekend possible and magical. The next panel meeting will be in this room and begin at 2:30 p.m. and the topic is Emmett Fox's The Sermon on the Mount. Excellent. Okay. Please help me thank our speakers and the reader again. All right, one more time. And after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, Daniel will lead us out with a prayer of his choice.
All right, let's go with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you. Thanks so much.